Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, investors, to episode 24 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm your host, Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kesslering.
Today is a lovely Friday, July 26th, 2019. It's hot out there. We're stuck inside reporting on a lot of important events that occurred in the market, everything from regulatory to global macro to fundamental company performance. I mean, we're right in the midst of Q2 reporting season. A lot of companies reported Q2 results this week, which we'll get into. We'll start off with T-Mobile and Sprint. So they won antitrust approval for their merger. What did the parties do to obtain the nod from the Department of Justice? Cantrus, the beleaguered cannabis firm, they actually fired their CEO and their chairman resigned as this scandal really deepens. We're going to talk about what happens now. Some economic growth figures. The U.S. economy grew at 2.1% in the second quarter, beating expectations. Is the Fed still going to cut rates next week? The ECB, the European Central Bank, signals upcoming rate cuts and a potential relaunch of monetary stimulus. Why is more stimulus necessary in the Eurozone economy? Finally, a regulator opens review into the big tech firms' market power. Why is the regulator concerned about these big tech firms? A big win for T-Mobile and Sprint shareholders, along with merger arbitragers, as the Department of Justice announced that it's going to approve their $26 billion merger. So T-Mobile, the nation's number three carrier by subscribers, and number four, Sprint, have spent weeks negotiating with antitrust enforcers, the Department of Justice, and each other over the transfer to Dish Networks, who is a third player here, for the building blocks of a network, effectively a new fourth competitor, of which Dish will be, to satisfy regulatory concerns that their more than $26 billion merger would hurt consumers by reducing price competition in the mobile offering market. This approval came after the parties agreed to divest assets to Dish Network in an effort to create a strong new fourth competitor. Because what is happening in this merger? T-Mobile, number three, is acquiring Sprint, number four. And without this new player, Dish, which just offers satellite TV services, they're looking to get into the mobile space. So without Dish, the regulator didn't want to see only three options for U.S. consumers. The strategic rationale behind the merger of T-Mobile and Sprint, which they've really been working on since pretty much 2013, so nearly 6 years for them to finally get approval. This deal would deliver a 5G network with lower prices, better quality, and thousands of jobs while unlocking $43 billion in synergies. Now, I believe that's not at all an annual number. The $43 billion would be the present value of the annualized cost savings in the deal. Now, this union of T-Mobile and Sprint, which was years in the making, as I said, almost 6 years, this would create a wireless company surpassing 90 million U.S. customers. And this is really closing the gap versus Verizon and AT&T, which are both roughly 100 million wireless subscribers. So it doesn't really push them ahead of what T-Mobile CEO John Legere claims, dumb and dumber, referring to AT&T and Verizon. So they're still going to be number three, but a much stronger number three player in competing against Verizon and AT&T. Now, the Justice Department and five state attorney generals, they stated they're filing a suit to enforce the settlement conditions that also include selling the Virgin Mobile and Sprint prepaid brands and providing Dish with access to 20,000 cell sites and hundreds of retail locations. So that what the DOJ is agreed that T-Mobile and Sprint need to do is really support Dish, divest these assets to Dish, such that Dish is a strong fourth competitor off the bat. They're divesting their prepaid brands to Dish and then giving Dish much operating support as it enters the mobile space. In addition to that, Dish has agreed to acquire Spectrum in a deal valued at $3.6 billion. And for this prepaid business, they're actually paying $1.4 billion. That gives them 9.3 million subscribers right off the bat. The FCC Chairman Ajit Pai and the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is another federal regulator in the U.S. They previously backed the deal a few months ago. They said Friday that the Justice Department settlement, coupled with T-Mobile and Sprint's earlier commitments to deploy a nationwide 5G network, which is why the FCC initially approved the deal, said it will preserve competition and advance U.S. leadership in rolling out next-generation networks, which was really important to the regulators here. And even, you know, the President Donald Trump wants to see the U.S. become a leader in 5G. And many of the players involved here indicated that this merger was really key to advance 5G in the U.S. Interesting to note that the FCC and the DOJ really haven't disagreed on a deal in decades, I think since the 1970s. So this deal kind of falling in line where they both agreed to approve it. This deal still faces one small challenge. A group of U.S. state attorney generals, they filed a lawsuit in federal court in New York to block the merger on antitrust grounds. They argue that it'll cost customers $4.5 billion annually, but I just, you know, I don't really see this as blocking the deal. It could add to some delays, but ultimately they typically fall in line with the federal regulators. Nonetheless, market participants, shareholders of the two companies really liking it. Sprint up 7.6% on the news today, T-Mobile up 5.2%. So really positive news in the mobile space for Sprint and T-Mobile with the DOJ approving their merger. What are your thoughts on this regulatory action?
When I saw the news this morning, I also saw a tweet that pointed out that when Legere took over T-Mobile, they were the number four player that had poor infrastructure and retail locations that couldn't even sell the iPhone, and now they've surpassed the number three player and also convinced regulators to allow a 3-4 merger. So if you would have asked investors back when he took control of T-Mobile if he was going to be able to do something as drastic as this, I mean, that's pretty crazy performance. And then he's also compounded returns for investors in that time frame as well. One other aspect, and I mean, obviously the DOJ, they, as you had mentioned, they were really concerned with the rollout of 5G networks. So that was a big aspect, is that they believe that they can roll this out faster because of the merger. But as well with the divestiture of the Boost Mobile and the prepaid business, I believe that Dish Network has been acquiring some spectrum in the auctions over the last couple of years, in addition to these subscribers that they already have. You know, do you want to comment a little bit on the strength of this fourth player that is now being created?
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about Dish because it's founder and CEO, Charlie Ergen. He's quite an interesting character. I know back in his younger days, he was a professional card player, and he's well known in deal negotiations for being quite difficult and bluffing. So a real savvy negotiator and some interesting history. Dish actually bid on Sprint a while back, way back when SoftBank acquired a controlling stake in Sprint. So SoftBank had a friendly deal to acquire its controlling stake in Sprint. I believe this would have been maybe 2011, in that range. So call it 7-8 years ago. And Dish came over the top, lobbed in a much higher offer, forcing SoftBank to pay a materially higher price for their Sprint interest. So some interesting dynamics between those firms. And for a long time, as you indicated, Dish has been acquiring a lot of spectrum, fueling market speculation that they're going to get into the mobile business at some point because their satellite TV business is really in long-term decline. Everything's going to streaming, and so they're looking for areas of growth. So they focused on the mobile sector, and they had long been a rumored bidder of T-Mobile. But as T-Mobile's fortunes have really changed, as you indicated, since John Legere came on as CEO, in 2013, he's really just absolutely crushed it. I think his performance as a CEO has been legendary, Hall of Fame worthy. He's certainly one of the best CEOs in American business today.
And most interesting.
Oh yeah, quite the character. I encourage everyone to follow him on Twitter. Very entertaining guy. especially on their conference calls and just berating his competitors, making fun of their results. And, you know, he also walks the walk as he talks about them because their results have been nothing but outstanding. As you indicated, tremendous results. The stock has compounded 30% annualized since he became CEO. In 2013, which is pretty tremendous performance. And operationally, T-Mobile has just been, you know, absolutely kicking ass there. I believe their stock hitting a new all-time high today, not just on the positive deal announcement, but also continually exceptional quarterly results, which they just reported yesterday. And so all things going very well at T-Mobile, and they're looking to consolidate Sprint there, and Dish becoming a fourth player in the business. Another thing I wanted to touch on is, as a merger arbitrager, you look how this deal, what it was structured like when it got announced, and as I indicated, there had been rumors over the past 6 years of these two parties combining. They actually had two false starts where the government indicated, no, we're going to block this deal, don't even bother officially announcing it because it's not going to get approved. You look over that history, now you look at how, you know, they officially announced the deal last year. As a merger arbitrager, you're trying to gauge the risk of the deal, or the chance of success of the deal actually closing, the risk of the deal falling apart. And you look back at it, and really no one could have ever thought this is how it would go in terms of Dish coming in, them creating a new fourth player with all these asset divestments to Dish. So it's really interesting from that perspective. And basically what an arbitrager would do is, you know, look at the risk reward basically on the first day where there's all that liquidity and establish a position on that and basically play those odds that something's going to happen in your favor, which certainly was the case here as the parties came to this really interesting, creative divestment agreement to bring Dish in as a strong fourth player into the market and ultimately get approval and look forward to closing this deal in the next few months. So I thought that was a really interesting dynamic there, and we will further see how these companies do in the future. The scandal really deepening at cannabis firm CanTrust. So what happened was embattled cannabis firm CanTrust, they fired their two most senior officials, including the CEO, Peter Aceto. They fired him with cause after media reports indicated that these top two executives, amongst others, knew of the company's illegal production of unlicensed cannabis. The company's chairman and co-founder, Eric Paul, also stepped down after facing demands from the company to resign. Now, they have a special committee investigating this whole scandal. What they're investigating is the breaches at the firm and these high-profile departures that stem from the special committee receiving new information. So apparently members of this special committee did not know previously to the media reporting. This management overhaul comes in the wake of evidence showing that both Aceto, the CEO, and Paul, the chairman, were made aware of the illegal activity at one of CanTrust's facilities last year. So to recap on what happened there was federal regulators began investigating CanTrust back in June after a tip from a former employee who turned whistleblower. He alleged that he helped stage photographs in CanTrust's greenhouse in Ontario to hide the fact that plants were growing in an unlicensed room. Now, since then, new information has come out confirming this whistleblower allegation, in addition to numerous other infractions that CanTrust really tried hiding from the regulator over the past 9 months or so, while Aceto was CEO. Now, media post BNN Bloomberg, they obtained documents this week showing that Aceto told staff to, quote, continue as planned with unlicensing planting back in November, which is obviously a big no-no if the tone of the top is that poor in judgment. Also, the Globe and Mail reported on an email from around the same time that was allegedly forwarded to Chairman Paul, and that acknowledged Health Canada had missed cultivation in that unlicensed room. So the email stated that CanTrust, quote, dodged a bullet when Health Canada missed seeing that hidden room. But, you know, that bullet seems to have ricocheted and caught them. Internal emails showed that the pair and other Camtrust officials, so the CEO, chairman, all the way down, they're made aware of the breaches of Health Canada regulations at their growing facility back in November, 7 months before the regulator uncovered the illegal practice. So what's happened since? Well, the price of Camtrust shares, they're down 60% since this news story broke back on July 8th. And, you know, this is really a company that is on fire, and that's not in a good way. We have seen precedents in the Canadian market where the marketplace just really loses faith in a publicly traded company. Short sellers pile on, and we have to disclose that we are, in fact, short the stock. We have been short the stock for a while. So some disclosure there. But as I stated, a company on fire. Let's look at some precedents. Well, one was Home Capital Group. That was another one that skirted regulations, and their stock price really tanked as institutional investors bailed out of the firm stock, and they really questioned the future viability of the company. You also saw it with Valeant Pharmaceuticals, a well-known massive blow-up. I believe their market cap was $100 billion, north of $100 billion, and they were, in fact, the number one company on the TSX right before that whole story blew up. And a smaller pharmaceutical blow-up was Concordia. So these have happened in the past. And what we've seen is that after these massive blow-ups where marketplace participants, shareholders really lose faith in the story, you know, more and more bad news comes out. And it seems like they never really recover. None of them, you know, went to zero or bankrupt, but their stock really tanked and really just stayed there. They never seemed to recoup their old highs. Actually, correction, Concordia did go bankrupt, so that was one that went kaput. But Valeant and Home Capital executing turnaround efforts. But I mean, that's probably the best that you can expect for Camtrust here. You know, they're not selling any product at the moment. They put all sales on hold. At best, they'll likely be forced to destroy a large swath of their inventory in the tens of millions of dollars. At worst, some analysts are speculating that they could face significant regulatory action on both sides of the border in both Canada and the U.S., ultimately face potentially losing their license, which would be a death blow to the company. What are your thoughts on this increasingly hairy situation? Oh, I just wanted to note the Buffett quote. You know, there's never just one cockroach in the kitchen. You see one, and then you're sure to meet their relatives in the days coming, which seems to be what is happening on Camtrust. I mean, the bad news just keeps getting worse and worse on this file.
Absolutely. And regarding Buffett, I mean, with Home Capital Group, he was the one who came in and effectively saved the company with his loan and basically loaning out his reputation to the company. Camtrust, I don't believe, will be as lucky. I don't think there's going to be any white knight that comes in and kind of saves the day. But you had mentioned that the stock is down about 60%, which is interesting because there still might be some downside here, as I believe it was an analyst from 8 Capital had quoted that about 70% of their inventory balance is on hold currently. So there still could be some downside here. Never really know in situations like these. But the ironic thing is that it was alleged, I believe, in the Financial Post that the CEO was even shown in a promotional video outside one of the illegal growing rooms in early 2019, which just brings this story to almost comedic levels, right?
Yeah, just a total facepalm. And I did watch the video, and it was confirmed that he did record a publicly promoted video in which he is standing being interviewed in front of an unlicensed illegal grow room.
Yeah, which is very, very ironic. And yeah, the other aspect is that they did also, they raised $200 million in $200 million US in May. And so it's likely that there will be some shareholder lawsuits, as insiders did sell about $30 million worth of shares into that offering. So the underwriters of that offering, which includes some of the major Canadian banks, will undoubtedly not be happy about that and may look at legal action.
more than likely, this is undoubtedly securities fraud. In my opinion, as you indicated, CanTrust doing an equity offering, a secondary equity offering of nearly $200 million just in May. And this was underwritten by Bank of America, Citigroup, Jefferies, Credit Suisse. So clearly a lot of institutional buyers there at a price probably over double the current share price. And the worst part of this, as you mentioned, the chairman, he was selling stock in this equity offering while he knew about these illegal growing activities. So that is just, many people, I believe, would call that fraud. And so we'll see how that situation plays out, but likely to be a messy legal situation, both personally and for the company. Another thing I wanted to touch on is, you have this special committee investigating and potentially looking at all sorts of actions that the company would take. You mentioned in HomeCap, they found, a white knight willing to back the company. But in this one on CanTrust, I have heard rumors of, them potentially putting up the company for sale, seeking a white knight buyer. But I'm really skeptical that any company would step in here for two reasons. I mean, number one, just the unknown potential liability here. It's just far too risky for any acquirer's board of directors to justify that type of risky deal when you really don't know what sort of liabilities are attached to this this whole scandal involving the illegal growing, not just that, but the securities issues behind the financing that they did while in knowledge of these illegal activities. And number two, then you look at the entire what's going on in the cannabis industry. A lot of companies have done acquisitions of which they're now paying the price. They're announcing large write-offs from these past acquisitions. Everything from write-offs, their stocks are down significantly because the acquisitions haven't paid off as expected. And then some CEOs are even losing their jobs. The most highest profile being Bruce Linton of Canopy Growth, who actually got fired. And he's really the face of the industry, but got fired for doing too many deals and really not focusing on operational efficiency, which is where investors are really laser focused at this time. So they're really encouraging their companies not to consolidate, not to do acquisitions at this stage of the game. And so I think that's a number of trends working against CanTrust as they are rumored to potentially be seeking a buyer.
Absolutely. And even if they do lose their license, that would, logically, that might take them to the process of bankruptcy. So if you were interested in those assets, you'd probably just want the normal bankruptcy process to work itself out and then look at the assets.
Right, and so where everyone's at here, I think generally investors, potential acquirers, even if they're looking at this, everyone's ultimately going to wait to see the results of this Health Canada investigation, which should be, robust and lengthy. We probably won't hear anything about it for a while, but at this point, I mean, no good news at a CanTrust, and it just seems to be getting worse and worse. Now they have their CEO is out, stuck with an interim CEO, so they'll be looking for new leadership there, but this one is kind of rudderless at this point. Going to talk some economic growth figures with the U.S. economy growing at 2.1% annualized in the second quarter. Now, this beat economist consensus expectations of 1.8% growth in the quarter, so a strong number coming out of the U.S. for Q2. These strong economic growth numbers, they come amidst the expectation that the Federal Reserve is going to cut rates next week, which is pretty surprising because typically, as we discussed this in the past, the Fed, typically cuts rates in dire situations to prevent recessions when unemployment is rising. But, right now we have record unemployment near 3.6%. Economic growth figures coming in above consensus estimates. Now, the longest stretch of economic growth in U.S. history. So it's a really interesting dynamic, but it still looks like the Federal Reserve is going to come through with interest rate cuts next week, irrespective of these, above consensus GDP growth numbers. Now it's largely whether they're going to cut by 25 basis points, 0.25%, or 50 basis points. Now the market is pricing in effectively 100% chance of a cut next week. They're pointing to 83% chance of the 25 basis point cut and a 17% chance of this 50 basis point cut. So The effect that the strong economic growth number did have was reducing the market odds of that more aggressive 50 basis point cut coming through next week. Now, looking at all the components of the GDP figure, it reflected increases in consumer spending and government spending, while inventory investment, exports, business investment, and housing investment decreased. Some quotes here. So one from Bloomberg Economist stated that, quote, "The composition of growth toward consumer spending and away from investment will be sufficient to propel GDP modestly above trend." Interesting tweet out of President Donald Trump, not quite the economist, but I guess he figures one on Twitter. He stated, quote, "Q2 GDP up 2.1%. Not bad, considering we have that very heavy weight of the Federal Reserve anchor wrapped around our neck. Almost no inflation. USA is set to zoom!" Exclamation mark. Not too surprising to see President Trump criticizing the Federal Reserve, as he tends to often do. Quote here from Capital Economics, a chief U.S. economist. He stated, "This slowdown just about justifies a 25 basis point cut by the Fed next week, but the chances of a bigger 50 basis point reduction just receded further." Another quote from the chief economist at the conference board. He stated, "If the U.S. economy maintains its growth rate above 2%, it could moderate the appetite for further cuts later in the year." So certainly decreasing the probability of further rate cuts beyond the one expected next week. What are your thoughts on the US GDP figures and the whole rate cut issue?
So just to touch on a couple points that you made, you had mentioned the drawdown in business inventories. That actually accounted for 0.85%, subtracted about 0.85% from the overall GDP numbers. So without that, you'd be, getting in the range of 3% growth. And that's kind of a transitory issue. It's likely to reverse in the next quarter. The other aspect is, it's interesting that Trump made those comments, as you could argue that the impact of him with the trade wars has had a way larger impact than the Fed, as over the last quarter, exports actually fell 5.2%, while imports grew slightly, which is just expanding the trade deficit that Trump always complains about with the U.S., which is really just a direct causation of his trade wars. The other aspect is that consumer spending, you had mentioned that it was up. It was actually up 4.3% in Q2 versus 1.1% in Q1. And we are going to be talking a little bit about some of the large tech companies, but that is being seen in the Q2 results from some of these consumer-facing tech companies, where there is strong consumer demand. And just as a reminder, consumer spending does make up about two-thirds of the U.S. economy. So that is has a really big impact on GDP numbers.
One thing that I wanted to talk about here is the Fed's dual mandate, the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. One is maximum employment. And you look at the figures there, and U.S. unemployment rate really near all-time lows. So, check the box on satisfying that portion of the requirement. It's hard to argue that they're not at full employment. They're not seeing it through the inflation numbers, which they typically would see with full employment. You typically tend to see higher wage growth than is happening. But I mean, the unemployment figure kind of proves that there's a lot of people in jobs right now, and really no issue with unemployment. And then the second really is stable pricing. And they talk about stable prices with respect to CPI or consumer price index inflation. They generally target 2%. Inflation has been near there, but not quite. But it really makes you wonder, are rate cuts justified here? I mean, the S&P 500, Dow Jones, NASDAQ, all at or near all-time highs. Markets have been doing very excellent, but they're framing this rate cut as a, quote, insurance cut. Basically, they're trying to counteract any economic weakness that is largely coming internationally. So we talked about, adequate U.S. GDP growth numbers. It's not quite the north of 3% that Donald Trump wants, or, the 3.1% that they experienced in Q1. However, it is a pretty good number, 2.1%. They can't complain. And they're really going to enact these cuts to counteract two main things. I mean, there's a lot of weakness in Europe. Part of that is just, you know, the economy has been sluggish for a long time. The ECB is going to cut rates, which we're going to get into today. Not just that, but with Boris Johnson now taking leadership in the UK, it looks like Brexit is going to go ahead. And then number two, on the China front, there's some economic weakness there, numbers coming in below expectations. The trade war is really weighing on the Chinese economy. Not just that, but other economies back to Europe, we're seeing some weak numbers out of, you know, the driver behind the EU economy being Germany. Germany's coming out with some pretty weak economic figures there. So the Federal Reserve really framing this upcoming rate cut, which is going to happen. I think it's likely going to be 25 basis points, but I'm sure we'll be talking about this next week, really framing this as more of an insurance cut. And so it's not necessarily another entire cutting cycle. Who knows, could be one and done. Things could get worse, but they're really pretending to be data driven here, and data more so, you know, who knows how much of that has to do with Donald Trump really demanding rate cuts. But yeah, we'll report more on this as we see what they choose to do next week. Sticking to global macro, but moving across the pond to the Eurozone. Now, the ECB President Mario Draghi signaled that they're preparing to cut interest rates for the first time since 2016, while also indicating the potential restart of its bond buying program. Now, the ECB this week opted to keep their interest rate on hold, with the main refinancing rate remaining at zero and the deposit rate at negative 0.4%. So it is already negative, but they're likely to make it even more negative in the future, hinting at future additional rate cuts. In a move that paved the way for rate cuts in the next coming months, the governing council changed its forward guidance to say that it expects rates to remain, quote, at their present or lower levels, at least through the first half of this year or 2020. For the first half of 2020. Now, these stimulus measures aim to reinvigorate the struggling Eurozone economy, which, you know, we talk about that US GDP figure of 2.1%. I mean, the Eurozone, they're not even really close to that. They're kind of more in the 1% range, and inflation is coming in well below 2%. That said, it was expecting to keep its key interest rate at minus 0.4% or lower for the next foreseeable future. We'll kind of see where they're heading. The ECB's next policy meeting is on September 12th, in which they will likely enact this rate cut and potential additional monetary stimulus measures. So it's now increasingly looking like this September meeting will bring not just one, but rather a package of several monetary stimulus actions. But that is to be seen. Nonetheless, it really raises the questions about how much more the ECB can accomplish with its current toolkit. I mean, their key interest rate is already below zero, it's negative, and their balance sheet has swollen to around 40% of Eurozone economic output. Now, this is double the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. And as we previously discussed last year, the Federal Reserve was actually trying to shrink its balance sheet, but now the ECB looking to grow it. And in my opinion, you know, it could be really pushing on a string here. How much is this action going to actually affect the EU economy? People talking about, look, negative interest rates aren't helping. The banks are really struggling. Just look at the share prices of Deutsche Bank and many of the other European lenders, some of them hitting the share prices they haven't seen in decades. So the financials really struggling there, and kind of financials drive lending, which drive many other portions of the economy. Nonetheless, some market action, 10-year German government bonds hitting record low yields of nearly minus half a percent. The Eurozone currency, the euro, fell to almost its lowest level in more than 2 years. And then, you know, the net result, globally, we now have nearly $14 trillion in negative yielding debt, much of which is that of the European kind. What are your thoughts on really what's happening in the Eurozone and what the ECB is signaling that they're going to do?
Yeah, so it's looking like they're going to enact a rate cut of around 10, likely 10 basis points. That's what's at least being priced in by investors. But then you'd mentioned the bond buying program, the quantitative easing. And so for our listeners, they did stop their former QE back in December of 2018. And that was a 2.6 trillion euro bond buying program. And they had stopped that amid some signs that the region was recovering. And now if they do enact this again, the really crazy thing about this is that they'll have to alter some of their, they are self-imposed rules, but they will have to alter them that will allow them to own more than 33% of any individual government's debt. So when you talk about the Fed unwinding some of their balance sheet, this creates a real problem for in the future when they are wanting to unwind some of these positions where they hold, you know, upwards of 30% of a country's debt. I mean, that's going to, that you would think that would take a very long time to get off their balance sheet, if ever.
Yeah, not just that, but you look at what's happening in the market. We're seeing, you know, record bond prices, as shown by their negative yields. And you think about it, well, who's crazy enough to buy a negative yielding bond where it guarantees a loss in principal? Well, you think that, you know, the ECB is coming in buying up all the bonds. You look from a supply and demand perspective, they're really increasing demand, and, you know, everyone else is forced to get really poor prices. What happens when all of that reverses? And what is kind of confusing to some market participants is, you know, they're increasing their bond buying, but, you know, many yields are already negative, as we indicated. You know, everything from Germany to Portugal to France, they all have negative yielding bonds now. Is getting more negative going to help, right? So I think that potentially all this market manipulation, it's really just not having the desired effect of increasing inflation and increasing economic growth, just because things are so warped. It's really hard to have things function normally when, you know, it's really bizarre when you have all these negative yields. It really distorts the capital markets, really distorts the capital allocation process, really distorts, you know, the lending process of banks looking to lend to businesses, that ultimately that's the productivity growth that drives economic growth. And, you know, that whole process has really been broken by central bank actions, in my opinion here. So it's really interesting. There's clear evidence that what they have been doing hasn't been working. So they're now just going to keep pursuing that. And it's really quite the head scratcher, in my opinion. Lastly, we just wanted to touch on some regulatory actions from the Department of Justice. What they did this week, they announced a broad investigating into what they call leading online platforms to see if they have been engaging in, quote, practices that have reduced competition, stifled innovation, or otherwise harmed consumers. The regulator didn't name which companies they're investigating, but it's pretty much known that they're looking into Amazon, Facebook, and Google parent Alphabet. Now, the DOJ said in a statement that it would look into, quote, widespread concern expressed about search, social media, and some retail services online. So that's really foreshadowing, look, you know, it's Amazon, Facebook, and Google that we're really gonna focus on here. Interesting quote from, you know, a different part of the government is actually from U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. Had some choice words for Amazon. He stated that, I think if you look at Amazon, although there are certainly benefits to it, they've destroyed the retail industry across the United States, so there's no question they've limited competition. So interesting quote from U.S. Secretary Steve Mnuchin. Now, this DOJ move comes after the outgoing European Commission signaled it was also looking to become more aggressive in checking the market power of the largest online platform companies. Another interesting thing that happened from the regulatory side just this week. Now, this DOJ announcement of an investigation came actually one day before the FTC announced a record $5 billion fine against Facebook. Now, what they're going after Facebook for is really, you know, mishandling of data and all these privacy breaches of the people, you know, their customers, people who users of Facebook's giant online platform. Got a statement from Facebook here. They stated that the agreement that they signed will require a fundamental shift in the way we approach our work, and it will place additional responsibility on people building our products at every level of the company. It will mark a sharper turn toward privacy on a different scale than anything we've done in the past. But I mean, you know, you gotta really take these actions by Facebook with a grain of salt. They're just so tremendously profitable, and the reason they are profitable is because, you know, they really don't give a damn about anyone's privacy. They're really harvesting everyone's data, selling it for top dollar. And, you know, when you look at the results, their quarterly results, Q2 results, which came out this week, $16.9 billion in quarterly revenue, which is just mind-blowing, up 28% from a year ago. So they're enormous, have tremendous market power, and still growing like a startup, growing like crazy, 28% year-on-year revenue growth. They also posted $2.6 billion in profit. Now, this reflected a $2 billion charge as part of its $5 billion settlement with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and Facebook stock up 60% year-to-date. So the market is liking what they're doing, irrespective of this massive regulatory clampdown, the regulators coming after them more often, with the DOJ announcing this new big investigation, not just into what we see as Facebook, but also Amazon, Google. You know, Amazon dominates search, Facebook dominates social media, Amazon dominates retail, Google dominates search. You know, really cracking down on the dominance of these massive online platforms. What are your thoughts on the regulatory action here, and just, you know, the continued just wildly profitable results of these dominant tech companies?
Yeah, first with regards to Facebook, is although they did have this large settlement, it really doesn't change anything with regards to what they're able to capture for data or their advertising model. So in terms of their ongoing profitability, that won't really change. I just see a lot of lip service coming from Facebook, saying that they've been slapped on the wrist and that they've learned their lesson, but there really isn't too much to change anything moving forward. Another aspect that I found interesting was just the interaction between the DOJ and FTC, or lack of interaction. You know, this is really, you know, the DOJ now going after where there's some debate over what regulatory purview these tech companies come under, whether it be the DOJ or FTC. And then as well, you know, like, this is a reactionary move really by the US, by the DOJ, after the European Commission said in April that they were going to lower the bar for companies deemed dominant players and subject them to stricter antitrust rules, where Trump came in and said that the US should be handling this, not Europe. And then finally, the one last thing I'd like to point out is that of those names mentioned from the tech companies, so Facebook, Google, Amazon, and I did hear Apple being mentioned as well, but really just the main three, is that Microsoft is noticeably left off this list. And so if you would have asked somebody, you know, 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, if there was going to be antitrust, you know, concerns with any of the tech companies, you would have said Microsoft, as some of our listeners will remember back in the 90s, you know, Microsoft had one of the most famous antitrust cases, you know, in history. And so the fact that they aren't being, you know, have no concerns in this is quite interesting and quite a shift.
Certainly. And on the Facebook front, as you indicated, they, you know, it probably is lip service, and their attitude has always been to move fast and break things. And as we previously discussed, this whole Libra cryptocurrency, I mean, you know, that's kind of a facepalm moment. They're just asking for more regulatory scrutiny, and it really just shows how much they care about authorities, which is very little, in my opinion. You know, they're continuing to operate as they like. They're tremendously profitable, tremendously powerful. And you got a question, you know, is there some regulatory capture here, just because these big tech companies spend so much on lobbying the government, you know, and they have such control of their market. They're so entrenched. You know, is there any stopping them at this point? I guess we'll see, but you know, I don't think this DOJ investigation will amount to all that much, as you indicated. They previously went after Microsoft 20 years ago. Now you look at Microsoft, $1 trillion company, as dominant as ever, but clearly facing new competitors by the likes of Amazon, Facebook, Google, Apple. They're all going after each other's turf, but, you know, in terms of other startups to compete against them, you know, good luck. They typically just crush their competitors or just copy them, right? And that's it for episode 24 of the Absolute Return Podcast. If you enjoyed it, as always, you can check out more at absolutereturnpodcast.com. We will be back next week with a new episode, so look out for it then. In the meantime, check out our older episodes. Leave us a review if you'd like. We'll chat with you next week. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.